Let's see, now is the time. Yeah, this is the 5th of January, 1983.
Four. Yeah. Don't throw away a year.
And this is Gould Coleman talking with Don Cook in his office in Baker Laboratory. And as he has known for something like a year now, we've been going to get together on this occasion and talk about his perception of the College of Agriculture, as he has seen it from Day Hall or elsewhere, with the idea that anyone who is doing a history of the College of Agriculture might well benefit from his observation of events. Now, the first thing, Don, is to get down what your perspective has been. Where have you been during all of these years to look at things?
Well, I started out as a professor of chemistry in 1951. In 1963, I became associate dean of the Arts College. 1965, dean of the graduate school, in which, of course, I had a substantial interaction with the College of Agriculture as well as all other colleges on campus. And in 1964, I was acting provost for a year. Oh, I should add, I became vice president for research in 1969 and held the deanship of the graduate school and the vice presidency concurrently. 74, I became acting provost for a year. At that time, after that service, I remained as vice president for research, but absorbed the duties of policies on academic appointments. I was even acting affirmative action officer for a while, which is a bit unusual for a vice president for research. I left that post '83, and currently still professor of chemistry, and I have charge of occupational health and safety programs on campus. So I have had a lot of interaction across campus. I've seen a lot of the College of Agriculture.
So what's different about the College of Agriculture, aside from where it's located and where the steam pipes go and so forth?
Well, of course, it's statutory to begin with and has a mission that it owes the state. That does make it different to begin with.
Now, it's not automatically clear to me why it does, because doesn't Cornell University talk about its land-grant mission as though we were all involved?
It is true that the land-grant institution is Cornell University as a whole. There's no question about that. On the other hand, I think it's also fair to say that most of the interaction with the state and the citizens of the state does come from the statutory colleges. I would say that the College of Arts and Sciences has very little interaction with the citizens of the state as contrasted to the citizens of the United States. So there's no state focus in the endowed units as there is in the statutory units. The College of Agriculture in particular has a responsibility to the farmers of the state in particular. They do get out and help those farmers when the farmers need help. When they have some problems in Long Island, we get a group down there. Human Ecology functions in the same way, ILR and VET. So even though we are, as a whole, the land-grant institution, I think the focus is primarily in the statutory unit. So that's one difference. Of course, the statutory units, particularly the agriculture college, have what you might call a more applied mission. Very hard to separate, say, basic research and applied research. And there's a large gray area. In fact, the gray area is probably larger than all the rest of the area. But nonetheless, they do tend to look at problems that are closer to solutions rather than long-range problems. That doesn't, of course, include all components. Obviously, the researchers in the Department of Agriculture, or in the departments of the Agricultural College, do undertake very long research programs. But there is more of a bias toward the shorter range problems. I remember when I first came to Cornell in 51, that the researchers in the College of Agriculture were kind of looked down upon by the more purists in the, say, College of Arts and Science, physics and chemistry and whatnot. I think over years, though, that's gradually changed. More respect has developed for their research programs than had been back in those days. They probably also became more interested in longer range research problems. So I think over the years, the respect in the rest of the institution toward the College of Agricultural Research has increased. What other ways are they different? Well, one thing is they expect, the faculty seem to expect stronger leadership from the academic officers. There's a gradation in the university where deans have power of action versus those who have restricted roles. The dean of the College of Agriculture have always been fairly strong individuals, and the faculty expect it. I think that's becoming less so. I think the faculty is coming more toward a more democratic approach. But I think it still persists that the faculty do expect strong deans and accept strong deans. And in the Arts College, which I think is the other extreme, the whole college functions more in the mode of a committee than it does a leadership role on the part of the dean. So there are those differences across campus. Same thing is true at the department level. Department heads, as they used to be called in the College of Agriculture, had much more power of action than heads of departments in other areas. They served for indefinite terms and generally quite long term. Took a lot of unilateral action that would never have been tolerated in other parts of the campus. So I think that's another difference.
Let me ask how you felt about that. Was that a good thing?
has its pluses and minuses. As long as you have very good department heads, the system functions well. And the other, on the other hand, you don't always have good heads. Just statistically, you're liable to get someone who is not very good, and such a situation can do damage to a department. And, so the more democratic approach does protect you from that kind of damage. On the other hand, the freedom of action does get restricted by the more democratic approach, and you can't take the kind of actions at times that might be best to take. So there's kind of a trade-off of pluses and minuses to both systems, as I see it. What other differences there are? Well, I don't know if it's pertinent, but I think the administration backup in the College of Agriculture has always been more adequate than it has been elsewhere on campus. Number of employees, secretaries, and whatnot has been always significantly higher than the rest of the university. I think that the rest of the university is low on services, so it's not that the agricultural college is extravagant, but it's about where it ought to be. The other areas of campus are not where they ought to be, the kind of backup service, probably because of the adequacy of state funding over many, many years. Of course, another point is that the college does have research funds from the state, which is not available to other portions of the university. That's a difference. The faculty in the endowed units, if they need research money, they have to raise it themselves. Where there are funds available in the College of Agriculture on a relatively routine basis, that is a difference. I'm not sure it's all to the best, though. Faculty who are continuously supported year after year don't have that lean and hungry look that other faculty have who have to raise their money each year. So one can become complacent if you know the money's coming in each year.
I would think there would be another side to that matter, too. If the lean and hungry stands, it would move research in the direction of where the money was, which is not necessarily the same as the interests of Cornell.
I don't
Cornell.
See that as a particular problem. It does occur sometimes, but almost all people have access to money to do what they want to do. There's some faculty who kind of fall between the cracks as far as programs go and have to struggle more to get money because it doesn't fit this particular granting agency or that particular granting agency. But I think generally there is money available for what almost, in sciences anyway, for almost whatever one would want to do. That is, of course, not true in the social sciences, where there's very little money available to begin with, at least from the federal funding agencies. And in humanities, there's only trivial amounts available. But I think in the sciences, almost every interest is represented somewhere. I don't see that as a problem.
Let's go back to the first point you were making about this matter of credibility or respect. You're suggesting that we're more one university today than we have been. One doesn't cross some kind of a boundary in moving between the campuses anymore.
Or less.
Occasionally overhear student conversations as I'm walking along, which suggests that some awareness of a passage there. But I know that in Day Hall, at least among some of the trustees, there has been some discussion of whether we're one university or more than one university. And Mort Adams, for example, got a committee. I think it was instrumental in getting a committee appointed on land grant affairs that ultimately led to the appointment of a vice president.
Yes.
I wonder if you have any observations on this matter of one university or two, the extent to which central administration took an interest and a concern about the College of Agriculture. Was more, I guess a shorter way of saying it was Mort Adams' right.
Well, I think the business of setting up a vice president for land grant affairs was not the question of whether we're one or two universities. I think it was to interact with the state in a more efficient manner than we had been doing previously. In a sense, it wasn't a new post. Arthur Peterson served that role many, many years, and it was more a reassignment to a different person more than anything else, I think.
But I thought Art was there at the same time that the county...
Art was there at the same time, yeah. But it was a reassignment. Art used to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And perhaps an expansion of the role was also called for. But I think the administration pays as much attention to the statutory units as they do to other units. The last two provosts were from the statutory colleges. No. Let's see, Keith?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That last two. That's certainly an indication. There have always been people from the statutory college and the executive staff. Still are. Jim Spencer's another one. I just don't think that they look at the colleges any differently, except when it comes to the budget. Of course, the fact that the funds for the statutory colleges come from the state and we have little control over them other than trying to influence them. When we're dealing with budgetary matters, they certainly are two different units. Flow of money comes from different directions, and but I don't see any indication that the statutory colleges were handled any differently outside the budget making process. And don't forget, if you look at any university, take medical schools and universities. Just university populations in general, you'll find a medical school operates in a very different mode than the rest of the university, and the barriers between the medical school and the rest of the university are usually substantial. So I just don't think that's the way it has been, not my experience anyway.
Let me approach it from the direction of the College of Agriculture and how much interest they wanted on the part of central administration.
Yeah, that's a little harder to know. Probably varies with each dean. I'm sure some of them would rather have their own independence of action and they did get restricted by university policies. For example, academic policies apply across the whole university. That may have been a problem at times with some deans, I presume, who rather do things their own way rather than be restricted by university policy.
But that would be true of any dean. Like Dean Hollister, for example, in engineering.
Yes, I don't think the dean of the deans of the statutory colleges were any different than other deans who would rather have all power unto themselves, insofar as their faculties would let them.
Yeah, but in agriculture, there was a tradition of independence that, say, Dean Myers inherited.
Yes.
And so he could, it would be difficult for Dean, say, President Malott, to expect to have the same authority over the College of Agriculture when Dean Myers was there that he might expect to have in other colleges.
Probably so. For one thing, the funding comes from the state, in which the dean of the College of Agriculture has a good deal of influence. And you go back to Liberty Hyde Bailey, I guess the situation was even more critical. Bailey seemed to run the College of Agriculture as he saw fit. Obviously, I wasn't here, but that's how I understand it. Was not concerned much with what the university had to say about the College of Agriculture. That has certainly changed, though.
I think in Bailey's case it went beyond that, as he knew what was good for the entire university.
Perhaps, yeah. I think you might be right, Gould, yeah.
Well, now a time came when the Division of Biological Sciences was created.
Yes.
And that impinged mightily upon the dean's prerogatives in agriculture.
Very much so, yes. Because you had then a mixture of endowed and state funding in the sections, as they're called. So the deans did lose some of their power and influence over some of their faculty who were in the sections. I think in retrospect, that move to separating out the biological sciences as a division was a good move. I must admit that in the beginning I was worried about it, that it would separate the faculty and applied areas and they would thus lose the contact with the more fundamental sciences. I don't think that's happened, though. Mm-hmm. And I think it's turned out better than I had expected. So I think it was a good thing that it happened. But it does erode the power of the dean, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
Has less control over those section faculty because he doesn't pay a fair percentage of it.
All right. How did you think that was handled?
Oh, I think it was done well under the leadership, particularly of Bob Morrison. It was a traumatic issue at the time, of course. Break up some of those departments and remove some people from the departments. And it took a lot of courage to go ahead and do it. Who was dean?
Charlie
Palm at the time. I never knew whether he was supportive or not. And I suppose it's in the record and other people do know, but I just don't.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating to me. That so you were, at that point, dean of the graduate school.
Dean of the graduate school.
That suggests he didn't go very much public with his feelings, does it?
No, I don't think he did. How he privately thought, I don't know, but he didn't fight it publicly, certainly. There were a lot of faculty, though, who were strongly opposed to it. plus a good group that was strongly supportive.
Mm-hmm.
I think Dale Carson was the person who really played a very important role in the formation of the division. He was provost at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But all in all, I think it was a good thing.
You didn't feel that that established two classes of people, first class faculty, second class, put the label on?
It might be easy to say that that happened, but I don't think it did. I think it sort of separated out two different kinds of research in general. I don't think there are two classes of faculty emerged from that. I don't see any evidence that that's so. Some people may feel so, I don't know. I think there's a lot of respect across the boundary for the different research programs. One more fundamental. I suppose if you're looking for, say, a neurobiologist, it's easier to recruit them into a section called Neurobiology and Behavior than it might be in the Department of Agronomy. But that doesn't indicate two different classes of citizens. I just think they do somewhat different things. And here again, there's a lot of gray area overlapping in research, and there's two sections versus departments.
That was certainly a big concern at the time, wasn't it, of recruiting people? What sort of a structure
yes.
would be the most effective?
Right. And I think that had a good deal of substance to it. Of course, you must remember, back in those days also, there was a real shortage of faculty. It was very difficult to recruit faculty. It may be hard to believe in today's marketplace, but we had faculty lines that went unfilled for years just because we couldn't find anybody to take them. That was period when there was a real shortage of PhDs, and all universities across the country were expanding, many new openings, and that was a different situation than it is today.
Mm-hmm. You have any thoughts about academic freedom and how that was affected, if at all, by the stronger administrative structure in the College of Agriculture?
Well, academic freedom is a word that people define for their own purposes. I think it's the general idea of academic freedom is that the people are willing to have the right to say what they wish to say and publish what they wish to publish without retaliation. But it's been broadened out by many individuals to suit their own purposes, to define their own jobs as to whether they want to teach or not, and what kind of research they want to do. It becomes a hobby horse for a lot of people. But I don't think that was the basic concept of academic freedom when it was first surfaced.
Mm-hmm.
As to whether a strong dean makes a difference in the fundamental academic freedom of speech and publishing, it might have. Faculty member said something that the dean didn't like that impinged at the state level, a stronger dean could perhaps retaliate, yes.
Well, Let me take, for instance, here the College of Agriculture works through an extension service, and it's confusing to the clientele if you come up with two professors who come to different conclusions. So how does one reconcile that kind of a situation?
Well, I think that's putting it truthfully, Gould. I think it would be untruthful to say this is the way it is, even though a lot of people disagree with it. Tell the farmer to do this, and there's some other professor thinks he shouldn't. It's hard for the farmer, obviously, to weigh those things, but to come out with one line and say this is truth, when you're not at all sure that it is, would be worrisome to me.
Well, of course, it's not packaged as truth. It's packaged as recommended practices.
Yes. That's fair enough. Good point. I don't know how to answer the question.
A number of years ago, I did a book on the sugar beet industry in New York State, and it had become college policy to support that industry. And one of the faculty members up there was convinced this was going to be a fiasco. Turned out that he was right. And ultimately, he was told to keep quiet.
No, that's impinging on academic freedom, no question in my mind.
Okay.
Did he?
Did he
keep quiet?
He did.
Yeah.
No. He resented it bitterly.
Yeah, that's an erosion of academic freedom, no question in my mind.
And yet, if the college has a position, you wouldn't argue with the college taking a position on the matter?
No. I think what I would argue with is that he could not say, I disagree with the college position. I think he should be allowed to say that, and he should be allowed to say it publicly. And the college just has to recognize that there are people who disagree, and if the professor is right, he's right, and they should feel strongly enough or be convinced enough that they can withstand that sort of criticism.
Well, now let's add another dimension to it. Here was a highly politicized matter with millions and millions of dollars involved and jobs. And the publication of this professor was a reference point for the opposition. Became very important to withdraw or revise that.
I guess I just don't see it that way, Gould. If the idea is good and can prevail, it ought to be able to withstand criticism, even internal. I just don't think a university can be in a situation that said, this is our line and no one can disagree.
So I take it you know of very few cases similar to the one I have cited.
I know of very few cases. There have been some, but I don't know of many cases. Do you know of many?
No.
No.
I don't.
I think they're unusual.
I'm interested in the relationship between cash flow and research priorities. When Charlie Palm finished his long tenure up there, the advisory committee for the College of Agriculture asked him on the last meeting of his deanship to sort of summarize what he thought he'd accomplished during that 13 years. And as I look over, it's a 4 or 5 page statement. But what it adds up to me is I took care of my people. I worked very hard to take care of my people. And it looked to me like he did a good job of doing so. When you start taking care of your people, I'd suggest that you go where the money is, and encourage those activities which keep a good cash flow situation going.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. You do need money to run operations. You do need money to do research. And the more likely projects are to be supported, it's where really where you ought to build, because that's where the money usually goes, through the frontiers of science, and so the two are not incompatible. I don't object to that sort of thing happening.
Mm-hmm. So you're not in any way alarmist now about the investment, heavy capitalization of research in genetic engineering?
No, I think that's in the frontiers of science and an exciting aspect of the scientific world. I'm not alarmist at all about it. I don't know the point of your question as to whether you think there are moral issues involved.
No, I'm not. I'm not implying.
Yeah.
I'm not implying that.
Yeah.
All I'm implying is, I guess, is there are many concerns in society that don't get attached to the flow of money. And the university, presumably, has a broader, as the universe as its concern.
But I think the universities take longer range views too. Genetic engineering, for example, could have an enormous positive impact in this world. Food production could be radically changed through genetic engineering. I don't think the university should try to solve all problems of society. Just not within our capability. So I see no problems at all in concentrating on genetic engineering versus other particular fields of study. There'll always be faculty who worry about wars and international policy. We have them, and that's good. But on the other hand, it's probably not the things we do best. We do genetic engineering sorts of things best. So I don't see any problem. Broadly into biotechnology. I think it's an exciting business. I think it'll have major impacts in the future, hopefully positive. So I have little concern.
Now, you've been pretty optimistic in your view of, that is, not necessarily, what is it, rose-colored spectacles, but all during these events where a lot of folks have been pushing the panic button there in 69 and so forth, you sort of took the long view and didn't get all that excited.
That's true, I didn't. Of course, I had one particular piece of my background that was psychologically buttressed as good. I'd been in Eisenhower's war room during the war, so I'd seen what some of these things really were. So I never got as excited about it as other people did, perhaps because of that background. But I think I did take the long view and felt at that time this too will pass, as it did. For one thing, I'd read a lot about student revolts, and they're not at all uncommon internationally and in this country. We've had heirs of student revolts. The one prior to 69 was in 1933, where there were student uprisings at Columbia, City University, and not unlike the ones in 69, violence and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I thought that there'd be a phase we'd go through and survive. I think we survived, for reasons I don't understand, much better than many other countries.
There are those who attribute some of this happy outcome to the College of Agriculture and the sanity that prevailed there. Do you buy that?
No, I think you might talk about colleges of agriculture in general, or Midwest universities were much more conservative, so that the it was primarily on the East and West Coast that the universities were in turmoil. Nothing much happened in the University of Missouri or the University of Texas that really changed things very much. I think that's a regional political thing more than specifically colleges of agriculture.
I'm sorry, I didn't make myself clear that the reason that the student whatever we want to call it, challenge to governance here in 69, didn't take more radical dimensions than it did. It was due to the stabilizing effect on this campus of the College of Agriculture.
Well, perhaps there may have been more students at the barricade, or a higher percentage without the College of Agriculture. I think that's probably true. I think less so now than it used to be, the faculty of the College of Agriculture and the students of the College of Agriculture tended to be more conservative. I know if you went to a faculty cocktail party some years back, you could immediately tell what college you were. The people in the College of Agriculture, they would always introduce me as Vice President Cook or Dean Cook, and always more formal. They were well-dressed. They just looked at things differently compared to the same kind of affairs in other colleges, where no one would think of introducing me by their title. There was a certain formality that existed. Probably less so now. I think that was the case. So they probably are more stable, or at least used to be.
More traditional.
More traditional, I suppose. That's the word. Probably had a stabilizing influence, I suppose. But I'm not so sure. It was a major factor, may have been a factor. I'm not sure why other countries came out so much worse for the students. Wound up with a much greater influence in the operation of universities. Students in this country have very little influence on how a university operates. They're just not allowed to. It just never happens. That was the thrust of 69. It failed.
But the students never formed an effective national organization here.
They didn't even form an effective local organization.
That's right.
I think for one thing, they were all amateurs. In other countries, some of their students are not amateurs. Political people dominated by politics, pro or con the government. But we never developed that kind of political cadre in this country that other countries do. Perhaps the reason being is the students in other countries generally can go to school indefinitely. And here you have to get a degree or leave.
Yes.
Of course, there were changes that came about because of that. If you take the Kahn-Bauer report, which was written about 1967 or 68, making a lot of recommendations, and you read over those recommendations, you see that many of them actually came about. The general thrust was to make the university a more humane place. And I think it has become more humane. I think we do listen to students more than we used to. They don't have any more power, but at least they get listened to more. Mm-hmm. So I think positive aspects did come out of that, even though the times were bitter and difficult.
Another way of saying that is we know how to handle students better.
I don't think that, you know, there's no code to say how you handle students. It's just the innate reaction of people that worked, I think, more than any formal way of handling students. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm optimistic. I think universities will survive pretty much as they have in the past. There may be fewer students. They keep saying that year after year. So far it hasn't happened, but I guess it's bound to happen eventually. The enrollments will decline. So I'm generally optimistic about the state of the university. We always have money problems, and almost every year I've been here, even in the best of years in the 60s when the money was flowing in, we always had budget problems. Mm-hmm. If you have a good faculty, you think that they ought to be able to spend as much money as you can find for them and ask for more. It's not unnatural. I don't see any deep, dark clouds on the horizon. I think a higher educational establishment in the country has some very strong supporters. I mean, in positions of influence and power. Just look at industry themselves. They give billions each year to universities. Of course, they need to buy, they need the product of universities to train personnel. You look at our federal loan programs, I think indications are positive. I don't see any trend toward downgrading universities or colleges.
Now, what about this land-grant mission that I keep reading about, and somehow this university has a strong commitment to the public interest?
I think they do. I think, though, it is concentrated in the statutory colleges. For example, take the College of Engineering. I think they see a role for themselves in industry. And they might give some bias toward New York State industries, but if it's an industry in California that they interact with, I think beyond the slight bias, they look at industry on a national scale rather than a state scale. I think as far as the College of Arts and Sciences goes, and there's little feeling of a state mission. So I think it is the statutory college that carry the burden of our land grant status. Just the facts of life, Gould, that's all. They're used to it. It's been their tradition. And I think the college takes that role seriously. I think they are concerned about the state. In contrast to the whole nation that would concentrate their resources at the state level, where I don't see the College of Engineering doing that. So that's where the burden is. Even though it is the whole university that is the land grant institution.
Well, now, what else? What else do you know that one might not find in the records of the president of the university, or the dean of the College of Agriculture, or other administrators? No researcher is going to go through every piece of paper that happens to be in the archives. You were a witness and a shaper of events there. How about that? We haven't talked at all about personality and the effect of personality. I mean, you mentioned Dale Carson being a force in the biological sciences. But other than that, we've sort of talked about the tradition and the inheritance of a pattern and how behavior is shaped by that pattern. And then in terms of opportunities and how capital gets attached to opportunities. Personalities made any difference? You've sure seen a lot of them come and go.
Well, of course, they always do make differences. People's attitudes toward things do change the way they operate. But I don't see many Liberty Hyde Baileys recently. A very forceful personality that did things that they wanted to do and fought everybody who was opposed to them. That's a mode that's kind of disappeared in it. I don't think we can have those strong people in universities anymore. It's not the mode. They're too restricted in the power that they had. If you think who were the strong personalities in the university that really did something different, boy, you don't have a very long list. Can you think of any?
Oh, I think Hollister did.
Hollister did, yeah. But don't forget, that goes back away in times, too. I'm just trying to think of
Stewart, maybe, in botany, at least his own little...
I never knew him. When was he active?
Oh, he was active in the 50s and 60s and was a very strong-minded person who, in effect, had to be set up in, or seemed to have to be set up in his own department. Was not willing to be the sort of good soldier type that you're referring to in the College of Agriculture. Kicked over the traces. Went right to the president of the university if he didn't get a satisfactory answer.
Yeah. Of course, that again was some time ago. Maybe 20 years or more.
Really?
Think of somebody in the last 20 years who
had
a very forceful personality that really accomplished something. Boy, it's hard to think of At the moment, I can't even think of one person. I think you might mention Bob Morrison in the biology division. Bob Sproul and setting up the Material Science Center. It's a damn short list, too. Who in the college would you, in the last 20 years, say was a really forceful personality that did something? You know, we've had forceful personality.
But they haven't necessarily done much.
Was Stewart. Stewart was a very forceful personality. I don't think he ever did much with it. And was never able to accomplish a great deal. The system kind of reacted to him and swallowed him up, and nothing much ever happened.
Yeah.
You name some.
Yeah. Well,
maybe it's a sign of the times that things have changed so much.
you'll be interested to know that Liberty Hyde Bailey was appalled by, he did not resign for the reasons that he said he did, but he was appalled by how the system dominated the individual in 1913 and decided he could spend his life better elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Got out. And here we are 70 years later.
So what you're saying, it's always been true.
Well, he perceived it
that
way, but he was an unusually perceptive person.
I suspect it's become more restrictive than it was in those days.
So there's a system.
People could be independent, more so than now.
So now independence is discouraged, and system maintenance is encouraged, and the product is the result of moving past a number of workstations, and the idea is, as Harry Brauerman says in Labor Monopoly Capital, there's a sort of a de-skilling of the individual. The skills lie in the hands of the people who create the system, the Bob Sprouls and the Morrisons. And that is the system that creates the product.
I don't know why it's become more restrictive. At least I envisage it as being more restrictive. First of all, it's very hard to do things on an individual basis anymore. First of all, you need a committee. But that's not new. I have a quote from 1903 where a professor was complaining about the large number of committee meetings he had to attend and all the paperwork and whatnot. It's probably not new, but increased. But it's very hard to take action unilaterally anymore. Probably part of a more democratic process. Also, administrators don't want to get caught out in limbs anymore. So the whole growth of the committee system has had a major influence on individuality. And we don't even decide our budget anymore without input from committees. That's all new. And it restricts unilateral action of the kind we're talking about, where people went off on their own and did things. Doesn't happen anymore. Everybody has more input and power than they used to. As a whole, the system does. But the system is the people in the system, of course. They want that influence. So we don't have those giants anymore. At least in universities, I presume the business sector still have people who go out and do unusual things, build up organizations, sometimes destroy them. But there's a leveling in the university that makes that much less likely anymore. The fact that we can't think of many people in the past 20 years who we would classify as, you know, even Morrison and Sproul go back 15 or 20 years.
So this is the big theme then that is on your mind, is this leveling process.
Yeah. And the decline of leadership, yeah, because of restrictions.
Yeah. Leadership doesn't have much meaning anymore, does it? We still use it. That is, when somebody's review comes up, some administrator is being reviewed, then the inquiry is what kind of leadership
is
shown. But it's sort of just that's one of the questions one's supposed to ask.
Yeah.
It doesn't have much.
I think they only have the opportunity for limited leadership. Sometimes I think the way to run the system is do away with a lot of committees, let the president and the administration run the institution, and then every 5 years have a vote of confidence among the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
That's an impossible system.
Yeah.
Could never be implemented. Everybody wants to be involved in the decision-making process, which absorbs an awful lot of time of an awful lot of people.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
One person I might think of is Andy Schultz. Andy Schultz did kind of influence the engineering college. He and Dale, over a period, really changed it into more of a research operation. But even then, it was part of a national trend in any event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't single those two people out and say, well, they really accomplished that, because it was something that was happening in all engineering colleges.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that there isn't as much difference in Cornell and a lot of other places.
I think that's right.
They don't have Lake Cayuga down the road.
I think all universities of our kind are probably in the same boat.
And one wouldn't have said that in the 1920s, that there was still very distinctive qualities about Cornell, and even in the 30s.
I think that's probably right. And we're probably becoming more homogenized.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the fact that we're so aware of what's happening in other institutions. One thing, there's so much more communication, so much more meetings these days, that we are aware of what's happening, probably more so than we used to be.
One of the things that's occurred during your tenure here is the huge growth of the support staff and its organization and its development of national organizations itself. Business managers now go off and have their conventions.
Oh, sure. No, there has been a growth in the support staff. Enormous growth compared to the size of the institution, the number of students we're teaching, for example. I don't think that's unique to Cornell.
No,
I think it's true not only in universities, but in businesses. And part of it is regulation, no question. On the other hand, I think Parkinson's Law does prevail. An administrative system feeds on itself and keeps adding and adding, a lot of it just to take care of its own administration system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's inevitable. The beautiful table in Parkinson's book, I can't remember the numbers exactly, but points out in 1914, and when England had the largest navy in the world, they were managed, the Admiralty staff was something like 5,000 members. In 1975, when the navy had disappeared, the number of ships had declined by a factor of 10. It took 33,000 Admiralty staff to run a navy that didn't exist. And, I think that's a phenomenon that's prevalent everywhere. And I don't agree with all of Parkinson's reasons for it, but certainly the phenomena that he observed is correct. We've grown. I looked at a 1951 telephone book and looked at the number of offices in Day Hall.
Yeah.
The only one that disappeared, or two really, is a proctor's office has disappeared and the dean of women has disappeared. Yeah. All the others are still here, plus an enormous number of others.
Right.
Day Hall, for example, it became filled. We now have people, a lot of operations have moved out into other buildings. The bureaucracy does increase. And it just seems inevitable. There doesn't seem to be anything anybody can do about it. The overhead keeps increasing.
Mm-hmm. And yet you remain optimistic.
Well, and perhaps the one thing that could sink us would be increased bureaucracy and paperwork. But it's not only universities, it's our whole national society where bureaucracy is becoming more prevalent. I understand we're better off than most countries where it's even worse. Say Italy and France, where the government bureaucracy is enormously more difficult to deal with than it is ours. Perhaps it gives people work to do, I suppose, but that's a real problem. And I see no sign that it's going to change. I think we'll continue to add people. Although the federal bureaucracy, as far as number of people, is actually leveled off. It has not continued to increase. Total number of federal employees.
Well, now you better think of something else to say, because we can't end on that pessimistic note.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think it's the sort of thing that the system will somehow digest. It will make it universities, it'll make us less efficient. But I just think we'll survive it anyway, go and absorb that problem as we have absorbed many other problems.
Period.
Period.